It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper? A woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver. I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or
prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18+. Hello and welcome to Millions of Screens. I'm creative producer Leo Garcia, joined as always via Zoom by TV Awards editor Libby Hill and TV deputy editor Ben Travers. Today we're going to be discussing three shows coming back from the dead. Well, really only two shows. One is just a reunion.
It's the most zombie, though.
It is the most zombie of the three shows.
It's arguably the best of the three shows, and by arguably, I mean it definitely is.
That's right. We'll be giving Ben a chance to rebut what Libby and I said about Friends last week. He'll get 1 minute.
It is millions and millions of little screens.
Can't you shut up? I'm busy. Boy, what a great show.
Skipping ahead to the clicker and the meat of this week's episode, we're going to be talking about three shows that had their returns this weekend or soon to be. But we're going to start with the Friends reunion that Libby and I talked about last week. Ben, you get 1 minute. 1 minute to rebut anything Libby and I said last week about the Friends reunion. And go.
First of all, I don't even know where to start. Friends is an all-time great sitcom. Like, it's what's important to Friends, what's important to remember about Friends is that people tend to think of Friends as a broad comedy. They tend to lump it in with the multicam sitcoms that are, you know, a little bit more recent and a little bit, to put it frankly, dumber, like The Big Bang Theory. But Friends, the magic of it, the thing that everybody tends to talk about when they're like, oh man, we have to find a way to recreate that. We have to find the success. We have to model our show, you know, in a way that can be the next Friends, which happened, you know, far too often and was in far too many misguided ways in the past. It's not that, like, they put pretty people in front of the camera. It's not that they were all just lead characters. It's not that there was, you know, impeccable cast chemistry that was just, you know, too perfect to be.
Great job,
away.
Ben. Great job, Ben.
Way it was to go. The intimacy that they created with the audience.
Your time is up. Your time is up.
It is a personal favorite of mine that I have difficulty revisiting. I really loved it when it was on. Until, like, life got in the way. I like to wind Ben up, which is why I go all in on Friends hatred, but, like, I can still recite every line of the one with the embryos, the game show one. I was a very huge Friends fan, so I get it, and it is neither as good nor as bad as anyone on this podcast is making it sound.
Well, to bring it back to the topic at hand, one, yes, it is extremely easy to wind me up about Friends because I get extremely defensive about it, mainly because I do feel like there's a lot of misrepresentation when people talk about why Friends was so good. And when it comes to the Friends reunion, which is the reason that we're talking about Friends, the HBO Max delayed special that was originally supposed to help launch the platform a year ago before the pandemic struck and made it impossible to get as many people in the room together as they wanted for this nearly 2-hour reunion special. It is very long, and a third of it is clips, so that would have been fine, but the rest of it would have been a little tricky. What the special really fails to do is understand the show that it's trying to honor, which to me is just, it made it a very uncomfortable viewing experience. It made it very hard for me to watch the thing just from the perspective of someone who both has a lot of respect for the people who made this show and also wants to see that show discussed in a way that holds it to a higher standard than a lot of people want to hold it to. And none of that happened. But again, to get back to the original point that I tried to make and failed in the minute-long portion of this, what made Friends so special was that it treated its audience members as individuals, as the seventh friend. The way that it was shot, the way that it was, you know, kind of constructed as a hangout show, even the multicam like portion of it, really facilitated the idea that you were just in the room with them at all times, experiencing these things with them and making them like part of your friend group. Like you just kind of slid in there and became an intimate member of this ensemble. And I think that that's really the magic of the show. Like it was able to convince so many people, and there's a few people in the special. They have a brief section of kind of fans from around the world who talk about, you know, what made Friends so important to them. And a few of them mention, you know, it really made them feel like they were part of something when they were alone. If they'd moved to a new place, if they'd, you know, gone to college or, you know, lived alone or just didn't have a roommate or just were struggling at times, they'd turn this on and they'd feel that kind of communal atmosphere that you can typically only get by actually socializing with people. And that's, you know, obviously such an important thing to keep in mind during the pandemic. Like that's a service that the show could provide for people who were able to buy into that dynamic that the show created for them. But the special doesn't really do that. The special keeps doubling down on, you know, this was a huge show and everybody liked it and it was big and it was broad and it was literally just about these few big things that everybody knows, and we're going to call attention to those and we're going to have you tell the same stories over and over again. We're going to put you in front of a big audience. We're going to, you know, have these very planned out reveals that don't really work. We're going to bring back guest stars to literally wave and say hello and not speak. Like Thomas Lennon comes in for the for this thing. Like they do a gag where like three or four people put their hands out from behind a curtain and Joey has to pick his identical hand twin and he actually gets it right. And Thomas Lennon, who was again like a guest star on the show but also was the co-star of Matthew Perry in The Odd Couple on CBS, so he's pretty close with at least two of the people in the cast, doesn't say a word. He just gets shoved back into the background and has to go away. The same thing happens for Gunther, who has to video conference in, basically say all of the six cast members look good and then leave. Like it's just the special is so geared toward just look at these people. They're older now. Look at them. Remember when they were young, go watch the show again. That it doesn't do anything to remind you of why you were connected to them. It actively acts as an impediment to you connecting with this group again. And what made it all the more frustrating was at the very top of the special, they do something pretty clever, which, you know, obviously is designed to kind of pull at the heartstrings. But they introduce each member of the cast individually just as they walk into the stage. And the sound stage has been prepared. The Monica and Chandler's, Monica and Rachel's apartment, Joey and Chandler's apartment have been set decked, and they just walk in and look. And one by one they go in, so then they'll see each other and they'll greet each other, but they'll also just start pointing things out. And there's a very clear shot where you actually see that dividing line between the concrete of the soundstage and the floor of the apartment. And you're like, that's the line I never got to see. And now I'm walking it with them. Like now I'm in this moment with them and I just get to be there as the extra friend as this happens. Like I'm a part of this again. And they so quickly eliminate that in favor of bringing in James Corden and, you know, these horrible, big, crazy questions that it just kind of, it jolts you out of it. It takes you into this place where it's like, oh, I'm not experiencing this with them. I'm just one of a billion people who watched a TV show and I'm just fawning over these people being asked to play dress up again. Like it violates this kind of weird ethos that I think made the show special. And will it get people to watch the show again? Absolutely. You want to almost immediately reimmerse yourself in what was familiar to you to eradicate this thing you just saw. You'll probably go back and watch Friends again. But in terms of the special actually doing anything to bolster the show's deserved respect as a great sitcom, it just didn't do that. And I felt really bad about it because I'd like more people to understand why this thing was so special.
Well, this past weekend, guys, there were two shows that have been on hiatus or people thought would never come back that both debuted on Sunday. in HBO's In Treatment and Netflix's Master of None. Libby, I know you have thoughts on both of these shows.
Yeah.
But I want to throw to Ben, who just went on a 45-minute Friends tirade. Just
you'll
sort
never
of,
hear.
Just sort of get your lay of the land on the return of In Treatment and Master of None. Master of None, which was a huge surprise when we all found out there was a new season coming a few months ago. Yeah, so sort of your thoughts on these shows being resurrected in new ways.
I'm going to start with In Treatment, I guess, because I feel like we probably have a bit more to say about Master of None, but let's find out. In Treatment to me was a show that I only experienced in bits and pieces before. It was something when it aired originally, I'd catch like random episodes or kind of a series of episodes on cable when there was like a free HBO weekend, and I would get very, very invested, and then it would get ripped away from me and I'd just try to forget about it. And eventually I caught a little bit more and really enjoyed it. But going back to rewatch at least kind of the beginning of the original series before this fourth season that reinvents a lot of things came out reminded me of like so many of the little things that had to be done exactly right for the show to work, because essentially it is a stage play where you have two characters talking to one another. There's usually a bit of mystery as you're trying to figure out, you know, what are they saying? What does it mean when they say it this way? What does it mean when, what can I garner from what they're not saying? And you're kind of asked to get, you know, ushered into a role next to the therapist. Like you're trying to almost work in conjunction with him, or at least appreciate kind of the questions that he asked because you had similar questions or you wanted those answers or you can see how he's, you know, drawing them out. And there's drama there. There's a lot of really good, character work done by the actors, done by the writers, and it was a very impressive show. And honestly, those first few episodes, they will hook you right away. If you don't know what happens with those characters over the course of the first season, you're in for a real treat just kind of watching it unfold and enjoying the various twists and turns. And the new season to me, Uzo Adubo is the new therapist. She's incredible. There's a reason she has 3 Emmys. She's doing something completely different than the work she's done in those Emmy-winning shows. It's frankly kind of remarkable to think of Crazy Eyes as this therapist and be like, yeah, sure, that was the same person. That'll work. And it does. And she does immaculate work. The rest of the actors are also fantastic. I have some questions about some of the directorial choices. One of the things that I really admired about the early seasons of In Treatment were how they chose to very specifically focus on being in the room with these people, and kind of stepping out of that was a big choice. And in this, it's like, we know they don't trust the audience to do that with them, and they don't trust their own writing to kind of sustain it. So there's a ton of like, let's get up off the couch and walk around the apartment. Let's go outside the apartment. Let's look at, or not the apartment, the house, the very, very nice architectural find. Some of that doesn't necessarily work for me. Some of the ways the characters are developed don't work for me. But my biggest thing that I felt with the new season of In Treatment was that it didn't feel like they were as invested in the people as they were with the issues the people represented. They really want to talk about the issues that these people are dealing with because they're identifiable in the culture as we're living it. And there were too many moments for me in the first 16 episodes. Again, these are In Treatment does half-hour episodes where two air Sunday, two air Monday, so you get 4 new episodes per week. So you're getting like a, I mean, if you want to binge it, by all means, good luck. But you can also kind of pick and choose and just follow, you know, specific patients if you want to do that. Anyway, the format of it to me didn't quite hold up. There were too many moments where it just didn't feel like these people were real. It felt more like they were representative. And that kind of takes me out of it and makes it feel more like I'm listening to someone vent and listening to not necessarily a lecture, but at least one side of a lecture. And that kind of ruins the spell for me when I'm trying to invest in the authenticity of these people. And even if I wasn't, even if it was just supposed to be the drama, then the drama is a little bit amped up this year. There's much more melodrama involved in the therapist story, in Uzo Aduba's story, than was in the past when Gabriel Byrne was the star. So there's just little tweaks that I think could be pretty easily rectified, or maybe not easily rectified, but could be rectified in the right hands. So it's in treatment. That's it's back. They can make adjustments. It could be great again. I don't know. Libby, share your thoughts, please. I need to stop.
How
going.
Much of this is because of Joel Kinnaman, Ben?
Oh, honestly, much less than I feared. I was
I thought so.
Very, very worried when I learned that Joel Kinnaman was.
You know you were.
He's not a series regular, is he? Because he's not in enough. He's in.
He's
like,
recurring.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And he's actually fine. I think it was pretty good casting for the character he's asked to
very
play.
Interesting casting, I think, and kind of goes back to sort of his plays around with those dirtbag roots that he, in those roles he used to play.
Much like, closer to The Killing than some of his more recent stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which he was good in. He was good.
Yeah, he was really good in The Killing. He was a really interesting actor in The Killing, let's say. Yeah. I love your take on this, Ben, because I watched the first 16 episodes of this season of In Treatment, and I was left a little cold, and I couldn't figure out why. I mean, there are stark differences from the original series, which I was a huge fan of. From the beginning, I am obsessed with psychological stuff, and Gabriel Byrne's amazing, and this was really, you know, in the heart of HBO's no one does drama like we do drama, which I think is a very significant representation of maybe the difference between In Treatment now and In Treatment then. In Treatment then was a very I don't know, a more subtle show than season four is. It seems, and I didn't actually revisit the originating seasons, but it seemed as though the series used to be less interested in Paul's private life than it was with Uzo Aduba's Dr. Brooke something, I can't remember, Dr. Brooke's life. And that throws the show off balance for me. The other problem, I think, is the existence of couples therapy, which is a window into actual therapy sessions with one of the, Dr. Brooke Taylor. Gosh, I knew it was just like plain Jane. Yeah. So it seems much more obsessed with Dr. Brooke Taylor's life, to an upsetting degree, I think. I think it throws off the balance of the show. I was appreciated with the original In Treatments that finding out things about Paul seemed sort of like a slow burn. You would get these windows into his private life, but they were furtive. They were furtive. Here we're just smacked down in the middle of Brooke Taylor's house, and she doesn't even have like a separate entrance private office that her patients are coming in. They're just walking through her front door. This beautiful California like manse. And it's strange because that's not the relationship a lot of people cultivate with their therapists. A lot of times it's very important to keep this sort of non-porous wall between you and your therapist, so you don't feel like there's judgment, so you're not busy thinking about them as opposed to yourself. It's one of the difficulties that people actually ran into during the pandemic when they had to move their therapy online, because all of a sudden you get a window directly into your therapist's home. In some cases, you're looking at what books they have on their bookshelves. Their cat is interrupting your session. Actually, I talk about a lot of this with Dr. Orna in an interview we'll be running next month. And it's different. And In Treatment is just all in on that. Like, we are in, for as much as we're out and about and in different places, we are in Dr. Brooks' home this entire time. And it feels both more and less claustrophobic than it used to feel in Paul's office. Because in Paul's office, you felt like that invisible person on the couch. You felt like the fly on the wall. But watching season four, you feel like someone watching a television show about therapy. That's what I miss. I also miss Diane Wiest was in the original seasons as Paul's personal, therapist, professional therapist. It's actually something, again, we see in couples therapy. The central therapist has a colleague that they speak to in every week, in every episode. In treatment, it was one of the sessions every week was Paul's with his colleague. They sort of do that with season four. Not to great effect. Not with a colleague. And it hurts the show. I understand what they're trying to do. But it also feeds into one of those problems I talked about earlier about not having good boundaries. And not balancing the story very well.
They reach a point where I literally don't know if I'm supposed to trust Dr. Brooke when she's giving advice to people. Like, there's something very early on she does with her one Zoom client, where the episode is constructed to make you see how the advice would help her, would benefit her, and right. how she could be coaching him into a relationship with her that she needs more than he does.
Yeah.
And those kind of choices continue to ramp up throughout the season in a way where I was like, oh, this is kind of ruining the other patients and like everything else going on with the show.
I literally, when I talked to Zoe Dubas, an interview that will also run next month, asked her if she thought Dr. Brooke was a good therapist. So stay tuned for that answer. But I think will. The fact that, I mean, again, these were things that the early seasons of In Treatment dealt with. Paul made poor decisions sometimes. He made questionable decisions. He made decisions that came back on him that he had to deal with the ramifications of, had to deal with recriminations for. But there was never really a question at the baseline that he is 85% of the time a good therapist. I think season four plays with that line too much. I think it lives in a gray area that you don't want. And like, there is room for a show about a bad therapist, but that is also nightmare fuel for a country that really needs to get more people into therapy. So...
Also, we should mention, like, I feel like I didn't talk about this in the review either, and I don't think it's too spoilery to get into. Gabriel Byrne is a presence in the show. Like, he was her mentor, and there's, like, an offhanded comment, and I think we could do a whole other conversation about how the show handles the pandemic, but there's, like, an offhanded comment about how he's, like, the nation's doctor now. Like, he's so busy being the nation's doctor, like, the nation's therapist, whatever it is.
A little Fauci.
And
Yeah.
But, yeah. And there's hints that he will resurface in that role of like her therapist. And I feel like if that doesn't happen, it would be a huge betrayal because of how much they've gone down that road. But good Lord, do they need it? Like, it's almost like they need him to come in and be like, hold on, we got to steady this out. Like, use the character to steady her out. So then the show itself can be steadied out along with it. But anyway, I'll be tuning in to see that much at least.
This next show didn't have the 10 and a half years that In Treatment had between seasons. Rather, just four for Master of None. Granted, I don't think there was ever real plans for a season three. Even in 2017, Aziz Ansari had said that he didn't really have plans unless he like was married and had a kid and could really like change what the show was about. Then, of course, all the babe.com allegation stuff happened, and that sort of really threw any halting progress on a potential season three. Until this third season was announced with five episodes written and directed by Aziz and written by Aziz and Lena Waithe, starring Lena Waithe's character of Denise. And those all dropped on Sunday.
I should have liked this season of Master of None. That's how I will start this. This should have been right in my wheelhouse as a woman with a wife who has struggled with the strains of a long-term relationship, who has struggled with one partner having career success while another kind of stands by, who's struggled with whether or not to have children, with the struggle of whether or not you can have children, and IVF. And this should have been right up my alley, and it really left me cold. And I do think a very large part of it is the direction. Aziz sits in these long takes, excruciatingly long. Like, you know, you'll have seen shows before where it's like, oh, they should have ended this scene 10 seconds ago. And this is something like, oh, they should have ended this scene 90 seconds ago. He's doing it on purpose. And my wife points out that it's probably an homage to the filmmaking of Bergman. He settles back in the frame and he just kind of lets people do things and you're supposed to infer things. And it's fine, but it is this love story about this couple, and the entire amount of time you have to believe that this is a convincing couple and to be invested in this couple is 10 minutes. There is 10 minutes before it all starts to fall apart. Sorry, spoilers, I guess. Like, this is all spoilers, whatever. And my question is, how do you care that something's falling apart if you don't care that it was ever together? But there is one particular storyline that really sticks in my craw. But before I jump into that, I'm going to throw to Ben to see his take on kind of the entire season of this.
Well, first of all, I want to point out, because I don't feel like it's been discussed even close to enough, just how much this season leans on scenes from a marriage, specifically.
Yeah.
Like, even the initial scene of that series where the primary couple is being interviewed by somebody and, like, having their photograph taken is copied in Master of None, when Lena Waithe's character, who's a successful author, is trying to do a follow-up and a reporter shows up to profile, and then her partner gets welcomed into the conversation and they just sit down and talk about their past. And that's like an expositional technique, but it's also very much like a specific homage to scenes from a marriage. And even though it's been a long time since I've seen Scenes from Marriage all the way through, I can't wait to rewatch it because we've got a remake coming this year on HBO with Oscar Isaac, and that sounds great. The big bullet points of what happens in this relationship are also exactly what happens in Scenes from a Marriage. So, spoiler, I'm sorry, for Master of None Season 3, if you are more familiar with Scenes of a Marriage, you're gonna understand what these people are going through. And I feel like that is kind of one of my bigger problems with how the season felt. And I think it speaks to kind of what you're talking about, Libby. A lot of this feels like it's trapped between kind of an observation and an embodiment. So the way it's directed, the way it's written, the kind of homage that it's designed around, all kind of keep the characters at a distance for me. And yet the show is supposed to make you feel intimately close to these two specific people. I think that's a problem. So I do think the filmmaking is a problem. My larger take, though, and the one that I wrote primarily about in the review, mainly because I didn't want to spoil everything from, like,
it's hard not to.
Like, before it came out, I didn't want to spoil everything.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But it's that, to me, the early seasons of Master of None weren't so much about Aziz's character. Like, they by the end of season two, they really did focus on his particular relationship, and season one, you know, focuses pretty heavily on one of his particular relationships. But the beauty of it was that he was so eager to kind of go have all these different discussions, whether it was like spending time with his parents and turning his dad into a TV star, which, first of all, please bring back more of Mr. Ansari, he's great. Or, you know, going off with friends or traveling and being exposed to new people. Like, he was very eager and curious to kind of delve into all these other little stories. And that to me felt like what his book was about. That to me felt like what he kind of wanted to do as a filmmaker. He wanted to be just the curious kid running around asking questions and then making shows about the things that he discovered. And that works really well when you're doing little bite-sized stories of people. Like, that works really well when you're, you know, you're visiting these people for a half an hour or even 5 minutes within a half an hour, and you kind of get that perspective acknowledged, and then you go back to your main character, and then spending as much time as you do with Aziz's character in those first two seasons kind of warrants the further exploration of his individual relationships so that those have a very strong connection. But like you said, Libby, when we're just kind of thrown in with these with this new couple, and you don't have an immediate connection and there's not a ton of time spent devoted to that connection, it's a little bit jarring. And then it's like the ethos that he had is reversed. Like, he desperately wants to branch out throughout the season. You can see it in the moments when, like, they're in the waiting room and he hears those stray observational, like, commentary from the people walking by, and you're like, oh, that's an interesting statement that she just made. It's like, yeah, the camera wants to jump in with them and go off for a while, but
and
they can't.
I do too.
And that, I think that works better for his kind of storytelling as opposed to really trying to force something that wasn't there. And like, the name of this season was Moments in Love. So to me, like, the idea that you're just trying to capture the moment when they're in love and then how it falls apart, like seeing, okay, this is when they're at their peak, and then this is kind of the degradation, and then maybe it starts to loop back around, maybe it doesn't. That's an admirable goal, but it's really hard to tackle when you're trying to do it in a condensed amount of time and in the style that you prefer, and when you're paying homage so heavily to something that is very familiar structurally to people, it just kind of undermines the whole thing for me. So in short, the season felt far more familiar as opposed to both previous seasons and what I'd expect from this kind of storytelling.
Just to jump on the back of that, because it was scenes from a marriage that my wife was talking about, and she pointed out something to me that I hadn't consciously noticed, because she's much better with structure and craft stuff. There's really only jumped to close up once in the entire series, in the entire season, and Bergman doesn't do that. Bergman cuts in on his characters when it's a particularly emotional scene, something that would have had a much more interesting and needed effect and wouldn't have left me so cold. Like, the fly on the wall perspective in this case is torture. And I think it was almost excruciating to watch this. I know that's harsh language. It was very difficult to watch this coming out of a pandemic because I felt claustrophobic. I felt trapped in this relationship. I was like, oh my God, get away from each other. Like, you're just, it's not just, get away from each other. And so, as Ben said, someone walks through a lobby talking about something interesting. Like, all I want to do is run after them and follow them and eavesdrop. Like, I'll get a coffee and just, like, lurk behind them because I need to get away from what I'm trapped in right now. And I doubt that was the plan. But I'm going to go hyper specific with my overarching complaint about Master of None, which is how it handles a very particular storyline that I've actually seen a lot of praise for. Master of None gets into the journey of IVF for some couples. And let me start by saying part of my issue with this is that the season is wholly inconsistent financially. The couple has as much or as little money as they need at a certain time. At one point, someone talks about having a specific piece of furniture flown in from another country. And then on the other hand, they'll say, oh, we can't afford to go to a hospital to do, sperm injection, so we have to do the turkey baster method. And it's like, I don't, what? And then you'll see someone trying to enter IVF, and you know that you would appear that they have kind of a lower wage job, but then they're able to afford this cycle of IVF which without insurance is astronomical. People mortgage their cars. They put out second mortgages on their home to do cycles of IVF because many, many insurances don't cover any of it. So they get into this IVF story, but I feel like it's very surface level. The LA Times story said that they spoke to Ansari and he got the idea for it because he was talking to a friend on the phone who was going through it. And it really just felt like he was just like, whoa, that's crazy. And then I'm going to write about that. And then just kind of took what they told him. It doesn't have any lived in experience. It totally misses the fact that IVF is fucking boring. It's so boring and it takes so much time. It is fully a second job with injections and temperatures and other injections and pills and ultrasounds and you do all of this, and then a lot of times it doesn't work. And by it doesn't work, I mean you can't even get to the point you were supposed to go to get to the step that you needed to do before you could move on to another step. It was just this streamlined process, and there were setbacks, but they weren't insurmountable, and everything works out neatly in a 40-minute thing. And I realize I don't know how to say it other than they told the story wrong. It was dull, but it wasn't insightful. If you are unfamiliar with the process and that's what you saw, I just don't think you got what happens at all. And it hurts my feelings that it is then held up like, oh, this is representation. And I'm further hurt because this is a story about a queer couple, about a queer woman who is spoilers, who's trying to do this on her own. She has a sperm donor, but you know, IVF has to be done in a hospital setting. And there's no insurance set up for like people who want to try and conceive a child, that the problem with their fertility is that they are queer. There's no coding for that in insurance that like they don't have heterosexual sex, so they can't get pregnant, so they need to do this. Like, that is mentioned in passing, but they don't really get into, like, the privilege of being able to afford IVF. They don't get into further the struggles of the queer community to get basic medical care, but then also specialized medical care. They just have a layover in IVF town. They don't live there. They haven't spent any time there. Hell, they didn't even vacation there. They visited the airport. They picked up a brochure and they left. And that's not enough for me. And it hurt my feelings because I just think they could have and should have done better.
Well, isn't private life right there for them to look at as like an example of how this thing actually operates? It is to me, this sounds like in the world of IVF, it sounds like this is like a first stab by someone in your parlance who like heard the story and just wanted to tell it without the lived in experience. And then like in 20 years, there will have been other media like movies and television that cover IVF in a far more comprehensive manner, and we'll look back on this segment of the Master of None season and be like, that was cute and quaint, that like that's how the public perceived what IVF was,
right?
Almost like, right. Now when you look back and you know, stories about I'm gonna bring it up again, I'm sorry, but you look at Working Girl as a movie about like women can be empowered and do whatever, and you look and you're like, and it's Mike Nichols and it's all these people that you love. Oh, yeah. and you're like, in 1987, groundbreaking, earth-shattering. Oh, yeah. How like that a woman could do all these things, and now you're like, it almost feels as if it's mocking the idea that women can do things, like watching a movie like that,
right? And I, like it's things like boys don't cry. Like, you know, part of it is getting there, but it's not enough just to mention it or to talk about it. It's much more to understand it and then to derive an interesting and compelling story from it, all of which are different things. And it just, like, it feels weird to take a stand and be like, no, that's not good. I don't like that you like that because it's not good enough. But hey, that's where I'm at. And I'm very sorry, Netflix. And I really wanted to like it, but I didn't.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Guys, it is time for the mayor of Easttown murder power rankings. We only have one episode left. This will be the final rankings. And I think I've zeroed in on who the murderer is. But first...
Okay, hold...
First?
Hold on.
What?
We have breaking news. I don't know why they keep releasing these while we're doing our mayor segments, but there is breaking mayor of Easttown news that we can relay before we get into your murder...
Will it alter my rankings?
I don't think so.
Okay.
But it will... It may raise the stakes for your final murder power rankings.
Okay.
Because... The penultimate episode of HBO's newest hit, Mayor of Easttown, delivered 2 million viewers Sunday night across all platforms, more than doubling its total premiere night performance in April and nearly tripling its digital viewership since debut. This marks its third week as the number one series on HBO Max and its fifth consecutive week of growth. The only other HBO series to grow every week throughout its first season was The Undoing, which went on to average more than 13 million viewers across HBO platforms, blah, 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 blah. Mayor of Easttown is on track to be the biggest HBO hit on HBO Max to date. So the pressure is on, Leo.
Oh,
people are listening. They are watching. They give a shit. They're invested. Tell us what you think will happen.
Well, I was going to say, that's huge. What I do every week is I read the summary of the previous episode. And so for episode 6, the aptly titled Sore Must Be the Storm, which comes from Emily Dickinson poem, which I was not aware of. Mare wakes up in the hospital after a heroic wet rescue and faces the unyielding pain that comes from losing a friend. Mare finds a stunning clue after Chief Carter gives her a second chance. Richard hopes to strengthen his relationship with Mare. Those felt like the three story arcs of the episode. Not a single mention of a Ross boy in that synopsis.
Unimportant. Richard is the focus. Richard is what matters.
Richard bringing over some cold Rolling Rock. All the Philly faves. But yeah, we got to move right into the rankings. There's a lot of crazy talk online right now. And I think, as I've stated before, I'm probably 99% wrong. Well, they're just, I think there's a lot of, obviously a lot of stuff swirling around the show. I think people are worried that if it is too on the nose, people will be disappointed. If it is The Undoing, let's say, which I don't think, there's nothing that obvious as The Undoing was.
Well, yeah, because The Undoing basically just gave you one person and were like, did he do it or did he not do it? And yep. Then it was like, oh, he did it. Mayor has so many options, as evidenced by your ever-changing murder power rankings.
It shifts like the sands of the hourglass. These rankings, also just whatever mood I'm in, it changes.
These are the mayors of our Easttown.
Here's who's not on the list, but I have seen bandied about. Did Lori Ross do it? I don't think so. And that's why she's not in the five. I don't think she did it. But here we go. Top five, last ranking. 5, Dylan Hinchy. I don't think he did it, but he's up to some suspicious shit. He's lying to the cops. He's threatening people with a gun, saying, I'll kill you, like Aaron was shot in the face or whatever.
God, that dude sucks.
So, although he is bad, I don't think he committed the murder. I think he's up to some other... I think this is just a town full of fucking shitty dudes.
That's what I'm saying. It's a town full of losers.
It's a town full of shitty dudes in a country full of shitty dudes in a world full of shitty dudes.
Mare's got to jump in her car and pull out of there to win. You know what I mean?
I do know what you mean.
All right, Dylan Henschy's five.
New Jersey, but sure.
Yeah, Dylan Henschy's 5-4. Here's some defending Jacob energy. Could it be Child Ross? Could it be Ryan? Now, it doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense for Ryan to have done it. How did he get to that park in the middle of the night? How did he get his hands on a police-style gun? Something like the one that Mayor's dad used to have? I don't think it's him. He obviously has anger issues. I do think he maybe knows something about either Aaron's relationship with Billy and or John. And that the actual secret is not whatever relationship with the woman John had before. Or maybe that is Aaron. But it is the idea that, like, he is holding on to the trauma of, like, he is aware of a murder. And I think that's what's going on with Ryan. Number 3, Billy Ross. That's right. The cousin of the dad of the girl who was murdered. Billy, whose name I couldn't remember until he started becoming a major player.
Had to earn that memory.
Had to earn it, ended up in my
not
brain
even
space.
Listed on the characters, like, breakdown from HBO.
Billy. Yeah.
Savvy move by HBO.
Billy didn't do it. I don't know what Billy's trauma is. The fact he's being gaslit by his brother in such a crazy way, because I don't think he did it, but his brother is essentially force-feeding him to say, you did it, you killed her, and then I'm going to take you out fishing and kill you, and I'm going to tell everyone that you did it, so that it all points to you in some way, shape, or form. There's something obviously going on. I think, again, trauma is everywhere in this town. The Outsider, this really is the spiritual successor of The Outsider. El Cuco would love to hang in East Town and just suck up some of this grief.
Oh, man. I think Mayor would welcome El Cuco.
Oh, no, is it El Cuco?
Mayor would love it if El Cuco showed up in town. She'd be like, yeah, fucking go off.
What if this
I'm not even going to look into these.
What if this was a stealth Outsider reboot?
Yeah. Now we're into the top two. And I mean, I think this is where everyone's sort of leading with these two for different reasons. John Ross, bad man. Bad man. I think the last episode showcased it in full. I think that he is likely the Ross that bought the pendant. I think he more than likely is DJ's father. I think he's about to kill Billy at the river before Mare gets there. I thought the last moment of this of the episode was going to be a gunshot, like that Mare's walking and you hear a gunshot right. Far afield. That being said, if it's not John, guys, there's one person left.
Oh, fucking Christ.
Guys, it's Richard Ryan. It's Guy Pearce. Listen, you don't cast Guy Pearce to be a okay date. He's not great.
With the bad haircut.
Yeah, he's
he
not.
He brought the Rolling Rock.
He's not the greatest guy. He's not the worst guy. He's somewhere in between. He's a failed author, or he had one okay book.
He's fine. That's all a middle-aged woman can expect.
The rumor mill on Richard Ryan is insane to the various things, that he has some long-held vendetta against Mayor's family, and that essentially he's the one who sort of he killed Aaron and is trying to kill the Rosses and bring grief to her. A la El Cuco. He's like an El Cuco.
Is he El Cuco?
An El Cuco type.
El Cuco?
He's El Cuco. El Cuco. El Cuco? I don't know how he gets to Aaron. I love that I know my number one is wrong, but I'm sticking with my number one.
That's what I love about you, Leo. Like, your commitment to a bit is...
Richard Ryan was number one on my first on our first Murder Power Rankings. Guy Pearce was one, and I've come all the way back around. Guy Pearce, Richard Ryan, number one. He did it. He killed Aaron.
Ride that bomb all the way down, buddy.
He took Mayor's dad's gun and shot Aaron with it. I don't know why.
I have a lot of questions about the Murder Power Rankings. You said that number three definitely didn't do it. You said the first one did do it. So you're betting on Guy Pearce. But is there a possibility that the second one did it, or are the rankings literally just this one person definitely did it, and these other people are just the most suspicious?
My number one probably should be John Ross, but I'm sticking with that. I'm going out on a limb.
So he could have done it.
I'm trying to be right. I'm trying to guess. I'm trying to outmaneuver the show, Ben.
This is your Zendaya.
Well, no, I get it, but like you're also like, are you allowing for the possibility? Like if we were doing this as a prediction style Emmy thing, you know. When Libby bet hard on Zendaya, I believe I said, yeah, Zendaya could win. Yeah. I don't think she will. I'm betting on this other person. Are you saying John Ross could be the killer?
No, then I would flip those. I would say John Ross is the killer, but it could be Guy Pierce's Richard.
But in your mind, there are only two people who it could be.
I think Dylan Hinchy is an outsider. He would be a long shot.
Outsider.
Long shot.
I got you. I pick up what you're putting down.
And then the other Ross boys, I just outsider. Put in there. I put the other Ross boys in there just because, like, the Ross clan has some negative energy.
A lot of them. Yeah, there's something fucked
the dad,
up.
There's something up with the dad.
Well, I mean, he was on Rescue Me, so.
That's the problem. He's the catcher in Eight Men Out. Millions of Screens, a production of the Penske Media Corporation, IndieWire. Our theme is your featured excerpts of the classic YouTube video, Bjork Talking About TV, and Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Our editor-in-chief is Stan Harris Wrightson, and our publisher is James Israel, and our executive editor is Ann Donahue. Of the many shows that Friends served as the lead into, here are some of the few that didn't make it past two seasons. The Christina Applegate-led Jesse, the Jonathan Silverman vehicle, the single guy. Anthony Clark, starring as a good old boy from Virginia in Beantown in Boston Common. Good Morning Miami.
Should have gone.
Sarah Paulson, Ken Marino, and Regina King in something called Leap of Faith?
Sure.
The Brockmire 1.0 clone, starring Breckenmeyer on Inside Schwartz. Steven Weber, hot off his wing success on a show called Cursed. And then Michael Chiklis, post-commish, but pre The Shield, on a show called Daddy-O. Yeah, these are real.
Watch that.
These are all real. Yeah. And then here's what I'll say. Of all the shows that tried to replicate Friends' recipe for success, Millions of Screens strongly endorses Happy Endings, The New Girl, and Cougar Town?
Yeah. That.
I needed three.
Cougar Town's friends when they all turn into wine moms.
You can find us on Twitter at Million Screens, at Midwest Spitfire, Ben T. Travers, and Leah Garcia. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play. So leave a review and let us know what you think. This is Ben, Libby, and Leah. Remind you, as always, that you shouldn't let poets lie to you.
You shouldn't let poets lie to you.
Ain't nothing wrong with a couple of cold brews and a cool podcast.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.